Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I'm Darren Hefty.
And I'm Brian Hefty. Thanks for joining us today. We've got a great show for you. We're going to talk a little about late season alfalfa management. But as always, we would be happy to take your phone call if you've got anything you'd like to talk to us about or if you've got any questions for us. The number here is 844-44-AG-PHD. That's 844-442-4743. You can also email us, radio@agphd.com. We'll get to the Ag PhD mailbag a little later in the show. And you can find us on Twitter, Ag PhD Media, Darren Hefty, or Brian Hefty. So, Darren, I wanted to start the day by talking about an article I just read out of the Indianapolis Star. So this is the state of Indiana, one of the biggest ag states in the country. And basically, here was the title. It was, "What are drainage tiles and why are they an environmental issue?" So here's the line that really got me going. Okay, it says, "Crops need nutrients such as nitrogen and phosphorus. When those are applied, anything that the plants don't take up or is left behind in the soil during the off-season gets picked up by the water and carried away in the pipes. The pipes empty into the ditch, which then connects to the nearest waterway and ultimately into rivers and lakes." It's nice when you get facts when you write articles. I'm getting so sick of people, all this propaganda that's out there that's all nonsense. They don't research anything. They don't know anything. And then they write articles like this that make farmers look bad. Like, oh, if the farmer didn't use all his nitrogen and phosphorus, it all ends up in the river or a lake. That's ridiculous and one of the dumbest things that I've ever heard in my life. Phosphorus basically doesn't leach. So, I mean, unless you get way carried away and you got 1,000 times or 100 times too much phosphorus out there, phosphorus isn't leaching. Okay, we've studied tile lines for years and years and years and taken all kinds of water quality tests, and there's no phosphorus in there to speak of. So the phosphorus isn't going anywhere. So don't be saying that any extra phosphorus is going to end up in the tile water. That's ridiculous. And I mean, it's just blatant disregard for the facts. Now, in terms of nitrogen, is it possible that nitrate will end up in the tile? It's not only possible, it's going to happen. But here's the thing that you got to understand. All water has nitrate in it anyway. Go to any river or lake where there are zero tile lines and you will find nitrate in there, I will promise you. All water, I don't care what it is, has some level of nitrate in it. The more important thing to talk to people about is, well, how much nitrate is in there? How much is in there? Because a little bit isn't going to hurt anything. A lot, yes, that's going to cause some problems. What we care about is 10 parts per million of nitrate nitrogen. Now, maybe I missed it in this article, but I doubt that I did. But I didn't see anything talking about what the facts are with nitrate. And also the fact that there, when tile is put in the soil, there will be less total nitrogen that leaves the field when the field is tiled. And if you don't believe that, go look at the facts. Okay, I talked about this, I don't know, a week or two ago on the show when we were talking about drain tile. There's a really good publication out there that I often reference people to. It's a summary of 86 different studies, mostly university studies. And it's, let's see, I gotta remember the name. It's Environmental Benefits of Drainage Tile. And it's University of Guelph. So if you just simply look at that, environmental benefits, not harm to the environment, environmental benefits of drainage tile, then you will see the studies in there that show, hey, there's less total nitrogen leaving the field. And the reason why is because there's a lot less erosion in a field when you have tile in the ground. So anyway, when I see things like this, and I'm just so passionate about the fact that farmers in the United States and Canada are doing an amazing job, and we get very, very little credit. What we get is a whole bunch of nonsense put out by people that don't know what they're talking about, and they say we're doing bad things, when in reality, what we're doing most of the time is great for the environment And if you don't believe any of that, just look at start looking at the true numbers that have happened here in the last even 20 years. Food production's gone up. Cost of the food production per capita has gone down. We've got safer food, healthier food. We have far less erosion in the soils. By the way, people want to talk in the United States especially about this zone of hypoxia down in the Gulf of Mexico. And I've said it a couple times over the years here on the show, but I went to a seminar with one of the leading people who studied the zone of hypoxia. Okay, and this was at Iowa State a number of years ago. So I went to this thing, and the guy gets all done talking at the end, and I went up to him afterwards, and I said, okay, you went through all this stuff, but you didn't answer the two big questions that I've got. I said, here's question number one. How long have you roughly been keeping records, or has someone been keeping records on how big this zone of hypoxia is? And he said, well, roughly 100 years, Brian. And I said, okay, now here's my follow-up question. 100 years ago, how big was the zone of hypoxia compared to how big it is today? And he said, it's about the same size. Right at that point, I'm going, what? We'd had zero applied commercial fertilizer 100 years ago, basically. Today, we have obviously a whole bunch, and everybody's railing on farmers that they've done this terrible damage to the environment in the zone of hypoxia. And it's the same as it was 100 years ago. It's ridiculous. Why are we even talking about it? Okay, we shouldn't be talking about it, because anytime fresh water meets salt water, what do you think is going to happen? There's a zone of hypoxia. So this is why it's super important to learn the facts. And also, here's when you think about this and you go, well, I'm not on TV, or I don't do public speaking, or, you know, it's not that big a deal. It's not my problem. It's every farmer's problem. Because when you have a bunch of people spewing nonsense like this reporter from the Indianapolis Star, then it gives all of us farmers a bad name. So every farmer needs to learn the good things about tile, the good things about what we do on the farm, the good things about the overall health of our food supply, the nutrition value, and all the things that we do great as farmers. We do a tremendous amount, we don't get the credit, and I think it's ridiculous.
A lot to talk about on today's Ag PhD radio program. One of the things we're going to get into is some of the late season decisions you may make in your alfalfa fields. We'll also be taking your calls and agronomic questions at 844-44-AG-PHD. Stay tuned.
Stop losing money from your stored grain with the End Zone Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. Hot spots and moisture in your bin can cost you thousands in lost revenue. The End Zone monitors outside conditions to run your fans exactly when you want them to, naturally bringing your grain to ideal temperature and humidity. Master bin management with the End Zone. For more information, visit farmshopmfg.com.
Worried about glyphosate-resistant weeds and grasses in your corn? Unleash the power of new Impact Z herbicide and get the early post-application advantage you've been waiting for. Save $3 per acre when you combine Impact Z with a qualifying insecticide purchase. Go to buy2save3.com for details. Buy2save3 is a service mark, and Impact Z is a trademark owned by Ambac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
Acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, nobody scrutinizes performance like you do. And acre to acre, year to year, generation to generation, the consistent performance of Vasgro brand soybeans helps to keep your profitability out in front, offering leading agronomic expertise and 100% exclusive genetics for strong yield potential. Ask your dealer how much further you can grow when Vasgro leads the way. Always read and follow grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
What's the next big thing from the Roundup Ready Extend crop system? A soybean built on Roundup Ready to Extend technology, or one with glufosinate tolerance? Great news, it's both. Expected soon. Extend Flex Soybeans. Always read and follow IRM where applicable. Grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions. Commercial availability in 2021 is dependent on regulatory approval. No dicamba may be used in crop with Extend Flex Soybeans unless and until approved. And no dicamba formulations are currently registered for such use in the 2021 season. Learn more at extendflexsoy.com.
We're talking alfalfa production on today's Ag PhD radio show. Thanks for joining us. We get a lot of alfalfa questions and a lot of requests to talk a little bit more about this very important crop. So today is your day. If you're interested in alfalfa, we would love to hear from you and have you be part of this discussion. Our phone lines are already starting to light up here at 844-44-AG-PHD. Let's start off. We've got Irvin with us right now in Wyoming. Irvin, how are you doing today?
Good. How about you guys?
Good, good. You getting snow and freezing temperatures yet? What's it like out there?
We got 4 to 5 inches of snow yesterday. We got down to about 30 degrees last night, and we're at 45 right now.
Okay, so we already got some snow on the ground, and we're talking late season alfalfa management, and obviously a lot of decisions get made for you when you have snow laying on the alfalfa and freezing temperatures, but you know, when you look late season, how late in the year do you dare make that last cutting?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, we try...
Depends on how bad you need the feed?
Right. I mean, I guess I look and see how tall the hay is and if it's going to get a little bit of regrowth back on it.
Yeah, it's hard to outguess the weather. Now, a lot of times people will say, well, man, in my part of the country, weather can change on a dime, but it can change anywhere. But you are quite a ways north across the United States, and you do tend to get winter coming a little bit earlier than other places. So that certainly gets to impact what you're going to do on that last cutting. How about on the fertilization side, Irvin? Do you wait until spring with any fertility work you're doing, or do you like to get things out there in the fall?
You know, I do everything in the spring. March, around March, April, we start taking soil samples and checking those and then getting the fertilizer out.
You know, the soil sampling is one thing that we talk about a lot on the show here. How do you guys do it? Are you pulling, how big an area does a soil sample represent? Is it one sample per field? Is it 5 or 10 acre grids? What do you do in your part of Wyoming?
I do one sample per field. I just kind of go, I have our fertilizer company come in and core it, and they kind of go at an angle across the field and take, 10 or 20 samples, depending on how big the field is.
Sure, sure. And what do you find that you're normally short in your geography? Is it phosphorus? Is it potassium? Is it something else?
Phosphorus.
Yeah. I talked to a lot of producers just about the draw that alfalfa has on phosphorus. We've got a lot of hog production not too terribly far from where we farm, and those guys will say, man, alfalfa is a great way to use up a lot of phosphorus if you get a lot of phosphorus in the manure. Is it mostly commercial fertilizer in your area, or do you have livestock operations close by?
I do have some cattle of my own and some sheep, and we use some of that, but mostly it's all commercial fertilizer.
Okay. And one last question for you. Hay market this year in your part of the world in Wyoming, what was it like this year? Were you getting a good price? Were you able to find good quality hay out there too?
We have done very well on quality. I think we got a total of probably 3 or 4 inches of rain the whole summer. We've been hot and dry, and we've put up some beautiful hay this year.
Well, you're supposed to get rain every time you cut hay and lay it down. That's usually what happened to us when we used to be hay producers here. That was the only way you could count on a rain in the middle of the summer is just cut some hay.
We were praying for it, but it never happened.
Well, it doesn't work all the time, but it's worth a try, that's for sure. We're talking with Irvin out in Wyoming. Irvin, sorry to hear you got the snow already. Maybe you're happy about it just to get the moisture the way it sounds, but it sure isn't good for hay production in the fall.
No, we got a lot of hay down right now, so hopefully it's going to come back a little bit.
Yeah, it sounds like this weather's gonna turn around here in the next week. So, good luck to
you,
Irvin.
We're supposed to be back up. Okay, thank you.
Oh, you bet. Thank you. Yeah, it's supposed to warm back up for most of the farmers in the north. But yeah, it sure stinks when it cools down this much. I've got Dell on with us right now over in Michigan. Dell, did you guys get some of this cold snap coming through your area too?
Yes, we did. Yes.
No snow though in Michigan, was there?
Well, not down where I'm at. Maybe in the UP they might have, but I didn't hear any.
So what's on your mind today? Is it alfalfa production or something else?
Well, do you mind going back to the sprayers one more time?
Sure.
we talked about, you talked about the jar test, and I got me a clear glass gallon pickle jar and was going to do the test. Then all of a sudden I really realized I didn't know how to. I mean, you put a gallon of water in there, and what do you put? Two or three drops of each of the, how many drops do you put in? How do you know how to do a correct jar test?
Yep. What you'd have to do, Dell, is basically figure out how much is going to go into that tank of whatever it would happen to be.
And in what order?
Yep, and in what order. So let's just say, for example, you're spraying something that's 1 quart per acre, okay, and you're going to put that in normally 10 gallons of water. All right, so you got, that's 32 ounces and 10 gallons. So I simply divide the one by the other. That means for each 1 gallon.
It's 1/40, so it's 2.5.
Well, I've got 3 point, yeah, I got 3 point, what? What? 1 gallon is going to have 1/10 the amount, so it's 3.2 ounces, okay? So that's how I would figure it. So if I had a gallon container, I would put in 3.2 ounces of that product, and I would just mix it in the order that I'm putting it in. So if there, I mean, you can calculate it for anything that you're going to put in there, and that's basically what you have to do. So I'm just using 10 gallons because that's usually what
nice,
we spray
easy
is 10
round number two.
Yep, we normally spray at 10 gallons per acre. If you were spraying something at 20 gallons per acre, you get it divided by 20. So you can see how that goes and just run the numbers from there. And then, yes, you have to have something small to measure out 3.2 actual ounces to dump in there. So if you don't have any small measuring tools, then you're going to have a tough time and you're just simply guessing and throwing, oh, a drop or two or whatever. No, we want to be a little bit more precise than that.
Got it.
Yep. And then what you can do is shake that up a little bit and just sit it there for a little while. So then you're going to learn something. Number one, when you shake it up, if you're already seeing problems, okay, now we've got an issue. If you let it sit there and let's say 20 minutes later, it looks like it's totally separated out. Well, that could potentially be an issue. It hopefully isn't if you keep the agitation running, but you're going to learn some things pretty quickly. Now, the other thing that our guys will do is usually when we'll run this jar test and there's something that goes wrong, we say, okay, what can we do to fix that? Do we need to put more water in first? Do we need to switch the order of the products? Do we need to throw in a little bit of compatibility agent? So maybe we just need a tiny little bit of compatibility agent and that'll fix it, and sometimes it does. So fortunately, most of the time we don't have a lot of mixing issues. So I'm throwing out a lot of variables for you and giving you a lot of things to think about, but just know that most of the time, most of these things work fine. The biggest issue that we typically see with mixing is when people put dry flowable products, so dry products, in water that already has other herbicides or adjuvants in it. So those dries, like let's just take atrazine dry, that is designed to mix in water. It is not necessarily designed to mix in a water fertilizer blend or some other blend with chemical. So if you say, oh boy, I've already got a whole bunch of that stuff in the tank, well then what we commonly have to do is pre-slurry it. So we'll just dump it in a whole separate container, mix it up with water, and then dump it in. Hopefully you don't have to do that, but I mean, that's probably the biggest problem that we would commonly see people having is trying to throw a dry in and then the dry doesn't mix super well.
Thank you, thank you. I'm probably the only farmer that doesn't really know what a jar test was.
No, you're not. And some people have said, oh, no, nobody wants to do jar tests anymore, but I just don't like cleaning out junk out of the sprayer. And
in 1,000 gallons.
If you turn 1,000 gallons, not only have all the dollars that you put in that tank, it's just time, and then what do you do with the stuff? And what a pain. So, it's kudos to you. Get it done and then just avoid those problems.
Thank you, guys.
You bet. Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Talking about late season alfalfa management on our show today, and of course, answering any agronomic question you may have. Our phone lines are open at 844-44-AG-PHD. You can find us on Twitter, AG-PHD Media, Brian Hefty or Darren Hefty. Or you can email us, radio@agphd.com. And we have got a bunch of emails to get through today, later in the show, during the AG-PHD mailbag too. But we'd love to have your question also. Stay tuned. We will be right back.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy. All the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Your land is a legacy, a challenge from those who tended it before you to build on their foundations. At Corteva Agriscience, we understand what it means to be the stewards of a legacy. We embrace the challenge of building on the foundation of Dow AgroSciences to maintain your trust, to bring new solutions, to help you care for your land. See how we can help build your legacy at rangeandpasture.com.
If you're looking to get the most out of your foliar nutrition and fungicide programs, ask your ag retailer about Nutex EDA from Sipchem Agro. Nutex EDA has been proven to increase foliar micronutrient tissue levels and maintain those levels for an extended period of time. When tank mixed with fungicides, Nutex EDA helps support plant health, resulting in higher quality and yields. Nutex EDA is an affordable and effective solution that should be part of every grower's high-yield toolbox.
Find your full potential and increase your bottom line with branded generic herbicides from Atticus LLC. Tough broadleaf weeds are a hassle, but they're no match for Cavallo from Atticus. Cavallo delivers fast, contact, and residual control so your corn, soybean, and sorghum crops can thrive. Growers across the region count on Atticus for relevant and reliable products that deliver results every time. Ask your local retailer about Atticus products and visit AtticusLLC.com to learn more. For value-based solutions you can trust, turn to Atticus. Always read and follow label instructions.
Maintaining your crops is as important now as it's ever been. Howler, a revolutionary fungicide from AgBiome, can help. It provides long-lasting protection from a broad spectrum of foliar and soil diseases that affect crops. Howler is OMRI listed, has multiple modes of action, and has minimal pre-harvest and re-entry intervals. It's flexible, easy to use, and is available right now. Visit agbiome.com/howler to learn more.
Pentair Hypro Ultra Low Drift Nozzles are your ideal choice for the Enlist E3 herbicide system. With coverage comparable to flat fans and with 90% less drift, ULD nozzles meet all required standards for Enlist applications and provide optimal performance of contact herbicides. Learn more at pentair.com/hypro.
Stop losing money from your stored grain with the Endzone Fan Control System from Farm Shop MFG. The Endzone monitors outside conditions to run your fans so your grain naturally reaches ideal temperature and humidity. For more information, visit farmshopmfg.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Thanks for joining us today. Talking about late-season alfalfa management. Man, we started off talking to Irvin out in Wyoming. He's got 4 to 5 inches of snow that came yesterday on top of his alfalfa. And he said, man, we got a lot of alfalfa down out there. We hope that snow goes away pretty quick. And let's go to the opposite end of the country. We've got Rocky Lemus with us right now with Mississippi State. Rocky, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Well, pretty good. I would imagine the season's a little bit longer for alfalfa in Mississippi than it is in Wyoming.
That's correct. And we're dealing with environmental conditions that are totally different from Wyoming and Mississippi in the south right now. We're in a dry stretch here for a couple of weeks, and it's still temperatures in the mid-90s with a heat index in the lower 100s.
Wow. That's no fun. We went through some of that this summer. We've been kind of dry up here too, but yeah, that heat is relentless in Mississippi at times. So as you're talking with growers, when you get later on in the season, when it cools down a little bit in the fall, is that a good time to try and recover? Is there a window of time here where they just don't cut hay for a while when it's this hot and dry?
Depending on what kind of hay we're talking about, usually if we're talking about our warm season grasses, like Bermuda grass, Bahia grass, is still at an optimal time to cut hay and produce hay until almost the end of September, beginning of October. When we talk about legumes like alfalfa, this is the time when alfalfa is getting out of that summer slump and start to recover a little bit, and we'll see an increasing yield where we expect to have probably a harvest here in another 2 weeks, maybe towards the end of September. So one thing that I usually tell producers as the alfalfa start to recover and we're still there to get into those cool nights and cool temperatures, we try to make sure that producers give a little bit of a fertilizer, especially potassium, to help that alfalfa to recover and be able to obtain that extra cutting in the fall.
Yeah, that fertility piece is really important. And I know, especially as we talk to the high tonnage producing farmers, they talk about how much P and K alfalfa draws. I mean, it's great feed, and part of the reason why it's just packed with nutrients, but we've got to replenish those as we go back in the field. We have this strategy in the North Rocky, and I'm not sure if anyone in Mississippi is using this particular strategy, but we like to load up on fertility before we seed that alfalfa so that ground is going to be good and fertile, because we know P and K don't move down in our soil very well, so we're trying to get it out there and set the table for that alfalfa coming up, you know, being a 3 or 4 or 5 year crop. How about in Mississippi? Do producers load up on fertility up front, or are they trying to feed it between each cutting or between each season?
We usually try to, and we recommend that producers follow those recommendations, that we try to load up with potassium and phosphorus, especially this time of the year when we started to think about not only maintaining the stands, but if you're trying to establish a new stand, which we'll be planting here in, you know, towards the end of September, beginning of October, we want to make sure that when that alfalfa starts to germinate and we hit that moisture in October, that allows that plant to be able to develop a good root system for going through our winters. Even though our winters are not going to be as cold as you see in the Midwest, we still have that combination of cold temperatures and humidity, which can also put an impact on the establishment of those seedlings throughout the wintertime.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with you. If we can have a good, healthy stand going into the cool season or the off season, that's a good thing. We see the same thing, getting new crop established and just maintaining the health of that crop we've got so we don't lose a stand out there. That's a big deal. Now, I was just talking just in the last couple of days here with somebody in your pathology department who was talking about how much rust they've seen in soybeans and just some of these other disease problems that you've had this year. What kind of year has alfalfa had? Have you had any trouble insect-wise or disease-wise this year?
You know, actually, from the point of view of pest management, this has been a good year for us for alfalfa. We saw a little bit of aphids infestation early in the spring, and we were able to control those very early in the season. And since we have a very mild infestation that we're seeing throughout the season, usually armyworms is a major problem for us in the south that could also decimate an alfalfa field. So far this year have been a very low incidence of armyworms, which have helped producers not having to invest so much on in insecticides to control these pests and their management practices.
Well, that's okay. We can have an off year for the pests in alfalfa where they aren't really bothering us too much. That's good news, no doubt about that. And
right.
Like you say, if we get a little relief from some of this heat and dry weather that you've seen in Mississippi, that'd be really good here as this crop, like you say, comes out of the summer slump. We're talking with Rocky Limas down at Mississippi State University. Rocky, great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for the information today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You bet. Send out to Oregon. We've got Hunter with us right now, farms out there. Hunter, how are you doing today?
Good. How are you guys?
Good. All right. So we had a cold snap come through the mountains. How did it impact things where you're at in Oregon?
We've actually been pretty warm.
Sure, Hunter. Just missed that. When we're catching snow out here and cold temperatures, living the good life in Oregon. Okay, talk to me about your alfalfa crop.
So right now we're just cutting our third cutting. So this will be our last cutting of the year. And yeah, so we're just finishing up cutting today, and then we'll be baling here in the next day or two.
All right, that last cutting, and this is part of the reason we wanted to do the show today too, is just talking about that last cutting and what happens afterward. Obviously, you want to get some regrowth on that going into the winter season. Is this a time for more fertility additions where you're at, or do you wait till spring to start working on building things back up?
So yeah, we apply all our fertilizer in the spring. We don't really do much in the fall. So yeah, all our fertilizer application will take place in the spring.
Okay. I can get that. I think about where we're at, and we're going to be frozen ground and not necessarily the case where you're at through the winter, is it?
Yeah, I mean, we get pretty cold. Yeah, definitely through the winter into early spring, we're pretty cold. And then, I mean, eventually it starts warming up, you know, in March, April.
Okay. Yeah, not too much different than what we're used to. Yeah, but around that time we start seeing things thawing out and we can get going again out in the field. When you look at the life cycle of alfalfa in Oregon, what are you shooting for? Are you shooting for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years with your crop?
So where we're at, since we only do three cuttings, you know, we're able to, you know, get at least six to 8 years if we're lucky. You know, I've seen some stands go as long as 9, 10 plus if you really try to milk them out. But I mean, ideally, you know, 6 to 8 is probably pretty normal around here.
You know, one of the things that we've talked a lot about in winter wheat, we've got some growers who have been doing some fungicide treatments in the fall, seeing better winter survival and early season takeoff with that crop. What do you see in alfalfa? Are you utilizing much fungicide in what you're doing in your crop?
So we don't put any fungicide on. I have heard of guys try it. They have tried using, I'm trying to think what it is, one of the fungicides and trying to eliminate the black stem in the first cutting, and they found that it really didn't pencil out. Nobody was really paying any more for the hay than applying that herbicide or that fungicide.
Sure. You know, as we look at 2020, one good thing that we had going for us this year is the hay crop for a lot of farm operations. We're talking with Hunter out in Oregon right now, talking a little late season alfalfa management. Hunter, thank you so much. Really appreciate talking to you. Good luck here with this last cutting that you're getting.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Listening to Ag PhD Radio. We'll be right back after this.
A history of success means proven performance, but let's call performance what it is. Profitability and boosting yours, no matter what the season brings, is the goal of DeKalb brand corn. Backed by exclusive genetics, whole farm solutions, and unmatched dealer support, let nothing shake your perseverance. Ask your dealer how DeKalb brand corn can help you realize a future of performance. Always read and follow IRM where applicable, grain marketing and all other stewardship practices and pesticide label directions.
Success isn't just about maintaining your operation, how you make out for the season, or how much you can get from each acre. It's about doing precisely what needs to be done to feed your crop and grow your legacy, all the way down to the last drop. AgroLiquid Precision Crop Nutrition. Apply less, expect more. Find a retailer at agroliquid.com.
Revitech fungicide from BASF has been specifically developed for the selective soybean grower who doesn't compromise. If you think good is good enough, if you're okay with just achieving rather than overachieving, if average is your goal, this is not the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide, brand new chemistry, 3 no-excuse modes of action, 0 modes of compromise. Sounds like the fungicide for you. Revitech fungicide from BASF, that's smart. Always read and follow label directions.
When it comes to effective herbicide formulations, you know Nufarm. They've been bringing growers trusted brands like Burnmaster, Scorch, and Spitfire for decades, made right here in the USA. What's your favorite Nufarm brand? email it to turnuptheburn@newfarm.com and you'll be entered to win a monthly $1,000 product giveaway. In these unprecedented times, you're facing unprecedented pressure. New Farm's here to help.
Hey, Adam. New drone?
Not just any drone. I mounted a laser on it to take out weeds.
Look out for that tree. In the power lines!
Oh, it's heading for the house.
There's a simpler way to protect spring wheat from weeds. Perfect Match Herbicide. The broadest spectrum weed and grass control in one product. Learn more at PerfectMatchHerbicide.com. Always read and follow label directions.
The laser.
Oh my goodness, did you see Bob's gorgeous soybean rows?
Totally. I couldn't believe how clean, weed-free his entire field looked. I'm like, so jealous.
I heard he started using this new post-applied residual herbicide called Perpetuo, and it's burned down and long-lasting residual powers, making his soybeans, like, literally the talk of the town.
Ah, so Perpetuo's his secret.
Yep.
Talk to your retailer or visit Valent.com/Perpetuo to learn more.
Hey, everybody. Come on in. The Ag PhD mailbag is about to begin.
Thanks for listening to Ag PhD Radio today. We're right in the middle of the Ag PhD mailbag here, digging into your calls and agronomic questions throughout the rest of the show. You can send us an email, radio@agphd.com, or just give us a phone call, 844-44-AG-PHD. Got this one from Jeff, and he wanted to talk about alfalfa and grass mixes. He said, I believe Brian regularly comments that tonnage can be maximized by alfalfa and grass being grown separately, yes. And I easily agree with his hypothesis.
Okay.
I just want to make a comment here, too. Tonnage doesn't always equate to more money in the bank, and here's my story. Many hay growers are often planting mixed alfalfa grass to meet a specific customer need.
Sure.
In particular, the horse markets are demanding this product. There's little demand for first cutting pure alfalfa in our area. It would be sold as cow hay and transported out of the area. But if I grow hay mixed with alfalfa hay mixed with grass, I can sell the first crop for $250 a ton versus only $85 a ton for pure alfalfa. Since our first crop is the highest tonnage, the economics just don't catch up with pure alfalfa versus the mix for me.
Sure.
Keeping my mixed fields weed-free and healthy, though, I agree with you, is a challenge.
Yep.
The economics are driving my decision, though. Thank goodness my customer base for my corn and soybean operation doesn't demand me to grow those crops mixed as well. Hey, yeah. Thanks, Jeff. We really appreciate the comments.
Yeah, and we're not suggesting that anybody has to sell these things separately. You could blend them afterwards also, but I realize that it takes more effort. And at the end of the day, we care about three things here. Number one, obviously we're caring about yield, or in this case, it's tonnage. Two, we care about profitability. And three, we care about doing the right things for the soil and for the land and the water and, you know, just the environment in general. So, you know, it's not always about yield. It is on the farm something where you have to make money. And if you don't make money, then you can't do anything else and you're out of business. So you got to figure out a way to maximize the return on your acres responsibly. And I'm glad to hear that you have.
Got a picture here with a couple of corn ears from Billy up in northern Alberta. He said, I'm sending you a picture of some corn ears taken off one of my corn plants. Most of my corn looks like this. Thanks for the agronomic advice that allowed me to grow this crop at my northern latitude. Hey, Billy, thanks for the picture. Really appreciate it. You know, my fear for you is just that corn isn't far enough along at this stage of the game. I'm not sure what maturity that is, but hopefully you're missing the cool weather here and allowing that corn to fill out. But, you know, it looks like you've got really good length to those ears. That's one of the things that I'd comment on that I see a lot in the 70 and 80 day corns, that we can get some flex for length. We don't often get really good girth until we get up into the 83, 85 day corns. Then we start seeing a lot more girth. But yeah, if you can flex for length like you have, that's a lot of kernels on those ears. You got a lot of potential there, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I'll say too, Darren and I were talking about this yesterday. We work with a lot of farmers in North Dakota. And last year, many farmers in North Dakota got caught with wet corn and it got too late to even get it harvested. So that was a real challenge. Well, what we talk about is let's figure out how we can get whatever crop we're raising to maturity as often as possible. Sure, there are fluke weather events and things like that going on, so we have to look at that too. But anyway, the point was simply this. For both Darren and me, we had a lot of people that we work with who are raising 80 to 85 day corn in North Dakota, and our recommendation is always, and always has been, plant some really early stuff. Plant some 75 day corn, because typically you're getting a little higher test weight. It's going to be drier. Maybe you can blend that off. And then also, whenever you are that far north and you don't have a lot of heat units, you got to figure out what you can do to accelerate that crop. So things like having good drainage, having the right fertility, using better seed treatments. We have seed treatments now, so we can pop corn out of the ground days in advance sometimes. Also, you have to look at tillage. And while I realize let's just say in agriculture in general, there's a big trend to go away from tillage, and I get that, and there are great reasons why you should do that. But when you're that far north, you got to figure out how we're going to warm that soil up. And unfortunately, tillage is, that is still one of the best answers. And I'm not saying you have to do full-scale tillage, but like on our farm, and, you know, we farm in South Dakota, not in North Dakota, but it's still pretty darn cold here most of the time. We like strip till. It's got a big advantage over no-till for one major thing, and that's where we plant the rows, or we're in 30-inch rows. It's on average 7 degrees warmer. Well, you know what 7 degrees can do? Well, I guess you might not if you're in the south, but in the north, 7 degrees is, I mean, that is massive. That's a tremendous amount of heat more. So that's a really big deal.
All right. Thanks for the picture and the discussion that it's generating, Billy. Really appreciate that. Got this one from Brian in Montana. He said, love your show. Really enjoyed your soils clinic in Baltic last year. Hoping to attend again this February. My soil tests per Neil Kinsey's lab and also Midwest Labs show that I need molybdenum. Neil recommends putting on 7.5 ounces of sodium molybdate to the acre. My question is, could I mix that with my fall applied Valor ahead of next year's lentils? My normal rate is 2.5 to 2.6 ounces of Valor plus 16 ounces of RT3 in 10 gallons of water to the acre. The 50-pound box of molybdenum that's at 39% concentration would work out perfect in my 1,050-gallon sprayer.
You know, it's interesting that we get this question today, Darren, because Dell, just a little bit earlier in the show, asked about doing a jar test. That's probably what we'd recommend here. I don't think there would be a problem with that. We have mixed sodium molybdate with herbicides on our farm before, but I don't know your water. I don't know, you know, how everything will work for you necessarily. So I would just say jar test it first. Most likely it's going to work okay. One of the things we do talk about quite often with water that can cause problems, it could be high calcium, magnesium, iron, copper, chlorine, if it's like city water, rural water, and then pH. So you may want to use something to address those if you are having issues when you're doing your jar test. Otherwise, it's also possible that a compatibility agent could help make that mix work as well. So those are just some things to try if you have problems with the mixing.
All right. Thanks for the question, Brian. This one comes from Mike up in Ontario. He said, I got a question for you on soil pH and changes on my latest soil test. What would cause pH to lower by quite a bit over a four-year period? Now, I took samples in 2016. pHs ran 6.3 and 6.7 buffer. And that same spot in
the
field.
Wait, whoa. What do you mean buffer?
Buffer pH was 6.7.
Oh, so
just
the
regular pH
was
6.3. Okay. Buffer pH 6.7.
All right.
Now I'm at 5.7 for a regular pH, down from a 6.3, and I'm at 6.5 on the buffer pH. My cation exchange capacities run anywhere between 19 and 21. I've applied about 40 pounds of elemental sulfur total over the past 4 years, trying to build soil levels, but my sulfur parts per million actually went down. Could the pH difference be a lab discrepancy, drought, too much nitrogen not taken up by the wheat top dress? Could I actually have included some surface organic material that skewed the test? I'll throw that one out right away. No, because they'll pull that right out of your sample.
They should. Oh, yeah. It was. Wait, which? And well, go ahead.
And he's just wondering, did the pH really just change that much? And I just need to get back to liming.
It's possible that the pH could have changed that much. All the rest of your theories as to why it could have changed are possible.
Now, the sulfur, Brent, thinking we aren't applying enough sulfur, period. That's probably why that's going down.
Yeah, but let me finish on the first point. There's no guarantee that this is real, the 6.3 down to 5.7, unless you know for sure you are in the same spot of the field. We talk about this all the time, but pick a GPS spot in each grid or zone you're doing and go right to that spot, drive your vehicle up there, and just sample right around the vehicle. Pull 8 to 12 cores right around the vehicle. Now you have something repeatable. So unless you did that, then we don't know for sure if you have true data or not. As to the sulfur, 40 pounds over 4 years is nothing. So that's not going to change the pH at all. It's also not going to raise your soil test level because most likely your crop removed more sulfur than that. So that should explain that.
All right. Thanks for the question, Michael. And yeah, if you had any soil tests you wanted us to look at specifically, we'd sure be happy to. We'll get back to more Ag PhD mailbag questions right after this.
You deserve to have a building that will last for generations. With more than 110 years of experience and thousands of satisfied customers, Morton Buildings is the industry leader you can trust. Unlike other construction companies, you work with Morton Buildings craftsmen from conception to completion. There's no better time to buy. Lock in your new building for 2020 today. Contact your local Morton sales office or visit mortonbuildings.com.
Oh my goodness, did you see Bob's gorgeous soybean rows?
Totally. I couldn't believe how clean, weed-free his entire field looked. I'm like, so jealous.
I heard he started using this new post-applied residual herbicide called Perpetuo, and it's burned down and long-lasting residual powers, making his soybeans, like, literally the talk of the town.
Ah, so Perpetuo's his secret.
Yep.
Talk to your retailer or visit valent.com/perpetuo to learn more. Always read and follow label instructions.
Customer service goes a long way when trying something new. Ryan Shaw from Michigan shares how Soil Warrior helped him transition to strip tillage in his operation.
The Soil Warrior guys, they are amazing to work with. They made this jump in this transition extremely painless. One question that I get all the time is, how is the service and everything? And I said, well, actually, I get better service from them than I typically do my dealers uptown. They're just amazing.
More info at soilwarrior.com.
As a little girl, I always wanted to run the combine because it meant I was helping Dad. And Dad always said, farmers are helpers. I'm teaching that to my daughters, that farmers help our family, our neighbors, and our community. It's what I do at work. I help farmers get the equipment they need. My name is Kim. I'm a farmer, and I work for Case IH.
Case IH, built by farmers.
You would never plant seed or apply herbicide with a 20% success rate. So why are you still applying phosphorus fertilizer with a maximum availability of only 20%? Double your phosphate availability and increase yields with NutriCharge from AgroTech USA. NutriCharge's patent-pending technology protects phosphorus from negative chemical reactions that tie up your fertilizer investment. NutriCharge performs across all soil types and pHs. Contact AgroTech USA or your local Van Deese supply representative today.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Oh, I love when we get a stack of soil tests coming in, and I'm handing a big stack over to Brian for him to look through. And I'll just say this. If you've got some soils that you're really struggling on, you say, you know, I need another opinion on this, or here's my strategy. See what you think about this. What would you do different? We would love to take a look and see if we can help you. These soil tests come from Andy up in Ontario, and he says, the subject line says, high zinc problem. He said, I've got a farm that we've had for a few years.
I don't see it. By the way, I don't see a high zinc problem. He's got 8 to 15 parts per million zinc, as do we in most of our fields. And we want to get that in ratio with phosphorus, roughly 10 to 1, 8 to 1, something like that. Go ahead.
Okay. So he said,
put more phosphorus on, that'll solve it.
Yes. He said, I have a farm that we've had for a few years. Finally got a grid soil sample. It's got a hog barn on it. And we figured out it's received too much manure over the years, as you can probably tell by the attached soil test.
Actually, I can't, but go ahead.
My scatter chart for the phosphorus to zinc ratio shows a 3 to 4 to 1 ratio rather than a 10 to 1 ratio.
Right.
Now, I think the phosphorus levels are already high enough. It's going to next year.
Nope.
Is there anything I can do to correct it other than to stop putting on manure that has so much zinc?
No. Yes, there are many things you can do to correct this, but here's the first thing. You do not have too high a level of phosphorus. Most of what I'm seeing in the Olson test is 10 to 30. That's not enough for big-time yields. Anyway, so you need more anyway. And on the P1 phosphorus for your lower soil pHs, I see 30, 40, he's got so many here. So 20. I mean, you're not that high. You're not that high. I mean, on my farm, I want to be 100 on P1 or on Olson. So, you know, if let's say you were at 10 on average on the zinc, which I don't think you're even up to that. If you were at 10 there, you probably need to be at 80 parts per million on phosphorus, and that is absolutely not too high. Just make sure you're not laying it on the soil surface. Get it down in the ground so you don't have the risk of loss of erosion. The other thing, and why I say it doesn't appear to me that you're putting on too much manure. Your sodium levels are really low. Your salt levels are really low. Your potassium levels are really low. So I don't see it. I mean, if you're telling me that's where all your zinc is coming from, well, you know what you can do is change the ration there. But the other thing is you just put on a little bit of manure and then supplement with commercial fertilizer because you need a lot of potassium. You need some phosphorus. You need, I'm just looking here, maybe a little bit of copper. You definitely need a little bit of manganese. I mean, and you definitely need a lot of sulfur. So, I mean, there are many needs here, and I do not see it. Does not appear to me that manure has been overapplied. When we see overapplication of manure, we'll see in the hundreds for P1 phosphorus or Olson phosphorus. We'll see 10, 15% K. We'll see sodium levels at 3%. We'll see salt levels at 3%. I mean, we'll see just crazy things. That, to me, and those are the types of people where I go, hey, stop applying manure, please. It's killing you. It's hurting your yield. So, no, I think you're fine. But, yeah, if you want to cut back on the manure, that's fine with me. Just make sure you're supplementing with commercial fertilizer because you need a bunch of fertilizer on here to really maximize yield from the way it looks to me.
Okay. Thanks for the questions. Really appreciate that. This one comes from Jordan over in Bulgaria. And he said, first of all, thanks for what you're doing for farmers in the U.S., Canada, and around the world. I'm from Bulgaria and the only foreigner that I met anyway at your Neil Kinsey seminar this last spring.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering if it was the same person. Go ahead.
Yep. He said, I've got a question. He had a soil testing suggestion for us. I'm not going to detail all of that on the show, but thanks, Jordan. We will check into that. He said, I've got a question for you on my pre-emerge herbicide for winter wheat. He said, we're no-till. The wheat is going into canola and sunflower stubble, very little residue out there. And we've been using a product in our country. It's from FMC called Eagle 75EG, which is chlorosulfuron, which would be like Glean in your country. He said, normally we plant the wheat, we use the chlorosulfuron before emergence. I'm wondering, could I mix that with glyphosate for a pre-plant burndown?
Yes.
I certainly believe you could.
Yes.
The effect that I'm hoping to achieve is to kill everything growing now and have a little bit of residual from that chlorosulfuron to at least keep the weeds out until next spring. We're very dry, and the first fall rains will certainly pull the herbicide in. My other question is, can I put this on before I seed? Or will my air seeder, as I run through, break down he describes it as a film, but break through your layer of protection from the herbicide and let weed escapes come through where the drill moved the dirt?
Yeah, that's always a little bit of a possibility. I'm really not that worried about that. So I will say, though, usually we'll plant first and then we will spray. But if you want to do it the other way around, it's probably going to be just fine. I really would not get concerned about that at all. Also, I would just tell you, as soon as anybody brings up glean, I just think about that from years ago and a lot of use out in Montana and the Western Dakotas. And then we ended up with ALS-resistant kochia. So it is an ALS herbicide. It's a sulfonylurea, actually. But, I mean, it's in the ALS chemical family. And we have problems with these ALS-resistant weeds here in North America. So I don't know if you have that yet or not. Now, there is another pre that we talk about commonly, and I don't have the active ingredient off the top of my head, but Prepare is the name of it, P-R-E-P-A-R-E, Prepare. And that's an ALS herbicide, but it's got pretty good activity in grass, some residual, and we use that in front of wheat. Now, here in the U.S., Sharpen is labeled. And again, I don't remember the active ingredient off the top of my head, but Sharpen from BASF in the United States, you can look that up. If that's labeled there.
Prepare is flucarbazone.
Thank you. And anyway, with Sharpen, that is fantastic on broadleaf weeds. So if you start ending up with a big problem with just broadleaves, not grass, just broadleaves, then if that product would happen to be labeled in your country, that's what I would typically recommend in front of wheat. All right, next question there, Darren.
Well, it's funny that you had mentioned those products because what's coming up next is the same kind of thing. So this is from Josh down in Nebraska, and he said, what do you recommend for a burn down product behind 2020 soybeans in front of my 2021 winter wheat that I'm going to plant later this month?
Yep.
Sharpen and Gramoxone seems like the option of choice here. Also, on the note of herbicide, what do you recommend in the spring to add more residual? Many of the wheat herbicides are ALS based and don't give us control of Palmer pigweed in our geography.
Husky in the spring. So that your Palmer pigweed program is good rate of Sharpen down pre-emerge that can't be used post at all, and then Husky post-emerge. So you do those things, and now you should have your Palmer under pretty decent control, really. I'd also say let's never forget about cultural practices. We want to do everything we possibly can to raise the best, thickest, healthiest wheat, and when you do that, you've got better crop canopy, which chokes out most weeds. One final comment I'll make, two comments. One, if you were really concerned about grass, that's where we talk Prepare, as I was saying with the earlier question. But yeah, Sharpen's the way to go when broadleaves are your number one worry. But you mentioned putting it together with Gramoxone. Now, I don't mind Gramoxone. It's a fine weed killer. It'll burn down everything that's there like immediately, like within an hour. But it's very dangerous. So it's no more dangerous than the gasoline you pump in your car every day, but it's dangerous. So if you want something a little safer with a little less risk for anybody working in your farm, then I would switch to Liberty if you are still trying to kill Roundup resistant weeds. Otherwise, I mean, we used to always go Roundup plus Sharpen, but now maybe it's either Liberty or Gramoxone plus Sharpen.
And Sharpen, by the way, the active ingredient is saflufenacil. All right, I got a comment from Mike. He said, I'm in Kansas City today. It's 56 degrees, not snowing here, but pretty cool for this time of year. Hey, Mike, thanks for the comment. Really appreciate that. And I got one from Brian. He said, fall rains are the best. That mud is a sign that our grain is ready to harvest in New York. You must get a lot of fall rains up there. He said, other parts of the country could be different, but we don't mind the fall rain so much. Hey, Brian, thanks for that comment, too. You know, we get a lot of different questions that come in. We got a number of them that we didn't get to today. We'll try to get to some more of these questions tomorrow. But we do thank you for sending the questions in. A lot of tillage questions now. Starting to get a lot of the fall questions about what are we going to do and how are we going to handle these different field situations. Yeah, there's a lot of tough situations, especially considering some of the weather that different areas of the country have had the last few years here. And I know there's still some areas trying to fix some of the ruts that got created after a wet 2018 or 2019. Fortunately, in our area, it's fairly dry right now, so we're going to be able to get a lot of stuff done in the fall here. Hopefully, you will as well on your farm. Thanks for listening to today's program. Be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.